This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award. Are you doing excellent research that deserves recognition? The NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award recognizes bold young researchers who ask fundamental questions at the intersection of the life and social sciences. Researchers who take risks to address relevant and exciting questions with creative approaches, regardless of the research outcome. Submissions are due May 15th. Visit science.org/NOMIS, that's N-O-M-I-S, to apply today. Today's episode is brought to you by Heifer International. Heifer International's mission is to end hunger and poverty while caring for the earth. Heifer International works to end hunger by providing livestock, agricultural training, tools, and education to small-scale farmers. So give a gift of heifer this holiday season. Check out heifer.org/science for more information or call 888-548-6437. That's heifer.org/science. Heifer International, help end hunger. Welcome to the Science Podcast for December 2nd, 2016. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, Bjorn Emonts joins Alexa Billow to discuss the birth of stars in the spiderweb galaxy 10 billion years ago. And David Grimm is here with a roundup of stories from our daily news site. Now we have David Grimm, editor for our daily news site. He's here to talk about some recent online stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on ant kissing. So this article starts out by saying, you may have noticed that ants sometimes kiss each other. And I was, I haven't noticed that, Dave. So what does that look like?
I haven't noticed that either. But apparently ants will sometimes quickly press their mouths together face to face, and they are exchanging fluid. It's a process called trophallaxis.
Right. And trophallaxis is more than just fluid sharing. They're regurgitating food from their, quote, social stomachs. There's a lot of really fun words in this article. And so what is this about? Is this actually how non-foragers get fed?
We already sort of knew that one important role of trophallaxis was food sharing. But what the researchers investigated in this new study was whether there was something else going on, whether this was actually a form of communication.
Time to get in there, get some of that social fluid out and see what's in there.
That's right. And what the researchers did, they combed through the social fluid. They found a really wide array of chemicals, including growth, digestion, and immune-related proteins, nest mate recognition cues, a juvenile hormone, which actually is important for regulating ant reproduction, development, and behavior. So there's a lot of complex chemicals actually being exchanged in these ant kisses.
Now, just because you're sharing it doesn't mean anybody's actually feeling the effects of these chemicals. So they then took it to the experimental level and they introduced a chemical into the social gut or the social stomach.
Right. And they found that the ant larvae that received some of this hormone-laced food were twice as likely as control ants to mature into adults. And they grew up into what are called majors. And these are the bigger of the two worker castes in ant society. So this food doesn't just help feed larvae, it actually determines what they're going to be when they grow up. So there's actually some really important stuff being transferred, or as these researchers talk about, being communicated between ants when they kiss.
They also found similar chemical cocktails in other social insects, like another kind of ant and honeybees. Do they suspect that this is really widespread?
They think it's a possibility, maybe even to humans. You know, human babies drink breast milk when they're very young. And, you know, it's long been thought, well, they're just getting nutrition there. But what if they're getting something else?
You're going to be a worker.
Right.
Now we have a story on building immunity by climbing the social ladder. There's long been a correlation between being sickly and being low social status. But the arrow, you know, which direction this causation might be in this situation, has never really been shown. Now, the research that we're going to talk about today is from rhesus macaques. But is this initial observation, is this idea that there's this relationship between being kind of ill and being low status something that you see in a lot of hierarchical groups?
Well, if you think about people, think about maybe like homeless people. They tend to be sick. They tend to be addicted to drugs. I mean, that's a generalization. But the question, you know, getting back to your intro, Sarah, is are they sick because they're homeless and very low status, or are they very low status because they're very sick and addicted to drugs? And it's really hard to do well-controlled studies in people for obvious ethical reasons. That's why researchers turn to macaques here. And macaques live in a hierarchical society, sort of like we do. There are alpha macaques, macaques at the top, and these macaques tend to groom each other. There are low-status macaques, and these macaques tend to be ignored by the group or even attacked by their group. So researchers can sort of tell, like, who's who in the on the social ladder.
That's from observation. And then they went and they looked at markers of immune health. What exactly were they looking at, and what did they see when they looked at high versus low status individuals?
Well, first of all, they found a lot of genes that were really affected by the status of an individual in macaque society. So, and a lot of these genes are activated in natural killer cells, which are a type of white blood cell that fights infection. And what they found was that individuals at the top of the social ladder, their cells, their immune cells, seem to be a lot better at fighting infection, or at least fighting a simulated infection in a petri dish, than the cells of individuals that were much lower status.
So there we have our baseline. And then they went in there and they messed with the social hierarchy. How did they do that?
Right. Well, it turns out that if you've got a group of macaques and you introduced a new individual to that group, the individuals that get introduced earlier into the group tend to rise much higher in the social ladder than those that are introduced much more recently. And so what they could do was they could take individuals that were maybe high status, introduce them into another group and make them low status and vice versa. And what they found was changing the status actually changed the activity of their immune cells. Those that were switched from low to high status, their immune cells got a lot better at fighting infection and vice versa. And this was over the course of about 3 months.
So for me, the takeaway here is that striving definitely pays off. Or, okay, how about we need to see if this works in people and then decide if it's worth addressing in public health programs.
That's right. But, you know, this research is still in its early days because there's a lot of things that researchers didn't control for. I mean, these macaques all have different genetic histories. They have different family histories. And so we're talking about a study that it was just conducted over a few months, but doesn't really take into account a lot of the other factors that are going on with these animals. So still a little early to see whether this applies to people.
Last up, we have a story on an animal trial registry. So Dave, this is your story. I'm going to just dive right in. Why might something like a registry of animal research be needed?
Well, there's a big publication problem with animal research. And that publication problem is only about half of all studies on animals, or at least half of all experiments on animals, get published, it's thought. And a lot of these studies that do get published, other groups have a really hard time replicating them. Now, that's a big problem because pharmaceutical companies, biotech companies, when they're looking for a new drug, they often turn to these animal studies that are often done in universities, and they invest millions, sometimes billions of dollars in trying to create drugs that are based on these studies. And the vast majority of the time, these drugs don't work out. In fact, only about 11% of cancer drugs that seem to work in animals work in people. So there's this feeling that there's this big publication bias in animal research, that a lot of studies are not being published, that only positive studies or only positive experiments are being published. And that's giving this sort of false impression that a lot of drugs and therapies that are tested in these studies are actually valid.
Right. So this is to solve a problem with publication bias. Is there also an idea that a trial registry like this might reduce the use of animal subjects in research.
Exactly. And that's the other big point of this registry. One of the things researchers want to do is, or they're supposed to be doing, is trying to reduce the number of animals used in research to refine their experiments, or they're using less animals. The problem is, if you're secretive about your research, or you're not telling people what you're planning on doing before you do it, then if a lab across the country is thinking about doing a very similar study, they may do the exact same study that you do because they're not aware of your study, and therefore you have a lot of wasted resources, a lot of animals being the subject of these experiments that don't have to be the subject of these experiments. And so another idea of the registry is just sort of make this research a lot more transparent.
So you talk to people who research about this kind of research
right.
registry, and what did they find when they talked to, you know, a diverse set of animal researchers, people who would be involved in a registry if it came online?
Well, a lot of people agree that there's a lot of advantages: transparency, reducing the number of animals, even fostering collaborations. I mean, if maybe you don't have the resources to conduct a big animal study, you have some resources and you find out somebody else is thinking about conducting something similar, maybe you could partner up. But people have a lot of concerns as well. One of these being that if you're testing, say, a really experimental compound that you don't want anybody else to know about because you don't want to get scooped, you know, do you really want to put all that information in a publicly accessible registry? Other researchers are worried about animal rights activists. You know, should they be sharing all the details of all the experiments they're going to be doing with their animals? Is that going to make their lab the target of animal rights activists, extremists, things like that?
Going back to the point about, you know, secretiveness because of proprietary chemicals or compounds, this is something that hasn't come up with the human version of this. We have a registry for human trials. Why is it different?
Right. And, you know, since 2007, the FDA has mandated that people that are conducting human clinical trials register those in a database, pre-register those in a database. One of those is clinicaltrials.gov. That's the most popular. But with clinical trials, when you're talking about drugs or therapies, those are so far down the line, you don't necessarily have to worry about being scooped because nobody's going to be able to, at a moment's notice, like try to replicate 10 years of your research and scoop you. But with animal studies, things are at such an early phase that if you're a very small lab without a lot of resources and you're testing an experimental compound, if another lab that's maybe much bigger than yours gets a hold of that compound, they could potentially churn out a study faster than you could.
So what about the other hopes for this project? Can we look at what's happening with the human clinical trial registration and say we're going to see similar things happen?
Human clinical trials registries have only been mandated since 2007, and so it's less than a decade. So there's not enough data to actually figure out whether those registries have solved some of the similar problems that were happening with human clinical trials. But what the people behind this new study say is that even if this doesn't necessarily solve all the problems, just making people register will likely force them to try to conduct better studies, to try to publish more than they've been publishing, because now there will be a public record of what they said they were going to do, how many animals they're going to use. And if you say, I'm going to use 30 animals in this experiment, and you only publish a study that only has 10 animals in it, people are going to say, well, what happened to those 20 other animals? And we don't have those checks and balances right now.
Okay, so there's no quiz question this week because we're asking people to vote for the breakthrough of the year. Why don't you just throw out some suggestions there, Dave?
You mean like list like suggestions?
Just okay. A few teasers for what they could possibly okay. say is the best.
Planet X, human embryos in a dish, speedy Zika vaccines, ripples in space-time, and many more. We have 15 contenders for the biggest scientific breakthrough of 2016, and you can vote for your favorite on the site.
All right. And then what else is on the site this week?
Well, sir, we got a story about air bubbles that sink and steel spheres that rise in an unusual liquid. Also a story about charting the electric heartbeats of dust devils. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about, speaking of animal research, why the Spanish military has stepped in to fly animals to laboratories. Also, a story about a massive piece of legislation in the U.S. Congress that would give $5 billion to the National Institutes of Health. So be sure to check out all those stories on the site.
And vote for the breakthrough.
Yes, do that.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi.
The spiderweb galaxy is a huge galaxy in the making, made up of a cluster of smaller galaxies with vast gulfs between them. Those gaps are filled with gas, and according to results published this week in Science, new stars are being born directly from this gas. This new finding contradicts the idea that really big galaxies mostly form from smaller ones merging together, rather than growing their own stars. Bjorn Emens is one of the authors of this new finding, and he's here to tell us about it. I'm Alexa Billow. Bjorn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Alexa.
How far away is the spiderweb galaxy? What can we learn from such a young, distant galaxy that we can't learn from the ones that are right next door?
The spiderweb galaxy is about 10 billion light years away. Just to put it in a bit of perspective, a single light year is about 6 million times a million miles. If you look at the nearest star, for example, it takes about a little over 4 years for the light to get to us. So that means basically that if you look at the nearest star, when you see it, it's actually looking how it was 4 years ago. And the same with this galaxy. We're looking at this galaxy 10 billion light years ago, which basically means that we're seeing the galaxy as it was 10 billion years ago. So what we were basically doing in astronomy, when we are looking very back in space, we're actually looking back in time as well. So we're doing some sort of cosmic archaeology. So for this particular galaxy, for example, we're really looking back to a time when the universe was only about one-third of its current age. So by looking at these massive galaxies at these large distances, we really can study how these massive galaxies formed really during their childhood.
How far away can we see? Can we see more than 10 billion light years?
We can, actually. People have been able to see much further than that with modern-day telescopes. So it is difficult, but you can really push the boundary. Even less than a billion years after Big Bang, people see galaxies. So we can indeed go much further than this as well. But of course, for the details that we studied, we only stick to 10 billion light years, which is already one-third the age of the universe. So
that's more than twice the age of the Earth. That's really incredible.
It is, yeah.
So in the paper, you say that the gas in between star clusters contains material that was formed inside of other stars. Then it gets expelled into intergalactic space and it gets incorporated into new stars. How do you know that the gas is being recycled? And how does it get back out there?
So what we actually see is this giant cloud of gas. And we know this gas is mostly molecular hydrogen gas. Now, molecular hydrogen is basically the building material for stars and for galaxies. But there's a small problem with detecting molecular hydrogen. And the fact is, molecular hydrogen is very faint. So it's actually difficult to directly detect molecular hydrogen, even with big telescopes. So in this particular case, this giant cloud of gas, it actually had carbon monoxide molecules all across this gas. And of course, we know carbon monoxide here on Earth as well. It's a toxic gas. But for astronomers, it's actually a fantastic tool to study galaxy evolution. The thing about carbon monoxide is that it gives off radiation that is relatively bright. Compared to molecular hydrogen, for example, the carbon monoxide is much easier to see. So people really use this to study galaxies, even almost out to the edge of the universe. So we know this carbon monoxide is present across this gas. And the carbon monoxide consists of carbon and oxygen elements. Now, we know for sure that carbon and oxygen can only be made in the cores of stars. Basically, the pressures in stars are so high that new elements are created by fusion processes. The thing is that at the end of their lifetimes, especially for the most massive stars, they basically collapse under their own gravity. And when they do that, they actually expel all this material back in space in a single bang. It's called a supernova explosion. So these massive stars actually expel all this stuff that's created in the core back into the gas around them. So what we have here is this gas cloud that we see that on the one hand is forming new stars, and on the other hand actually consists of material made from previous stars. So really it's one kind of a big cosmic recycling factory.
So by the time this galaxy was forming 10 billion years ago, there are already stars that have grown old enough to die and get recycled.
Yes, indeed, there have been stars formed that were old enough to die. Stars were formed inside small galaxies within the gas cloud, and possibly even in the gas cloud itself. So there was already enough time to what we call enrich the gas, so enrich it with these heavy elements like carbon and oxygen.
Is the spiderweb galaxy at all like the Milky Way that we live in? Why do we need to know how it formed?
So actually, no, the spiderweb galaxy is not like the Milky Way, and it will actually not evolve in a galaxy like the Milky Way. Basically, if you look in the universe, very roughly speaking, there is two flavors of galaxies. So on the one hand, you have disk galaxies, which are basically flat disks, and that's like our Milky Way galaxy, for example. And on the other hand, you have what we call elliptical galaxies, and those are basically huge spheres of stars. So the spiderweb galaxy is going to evolve into one of these spheres of stars. And it's not just an elliptical, it's actually forming in the core of what we call a galaxy cluster. And a galaxy cluster is simply a region in space where hundreds to even thousands of galaxies come together under their own gravity. So in the cores of these clusters, we find the largest galaxies in the universe, these huge spheres of stars. And the spiderweb galaxy is going to evolve into one of these giant galaxies. Why is it important to know how it forms? Even if it's not the same as our Milky Way galaxy, still, it tells us a great deal about how galaxies evolved if you look at it in an earlier time in the universe. So by looking at these galaxies very far away, they tell us something about how these galaxies formed and how galaxies in general form.
In the paper, you talk about how galaxies, like really big galaxies like this, form in two stages. Why would there be a change? Why is there going to be a phase one and a phase two when this giant sphere of stars is coming together?
Well, basically what we are seeing is this giant galaxy bathing in this cloud of gas. And this was 10 billion years ago. We see that at that stage, the galaxy is really forming stars out of this cloud of gas. And it can do so for a long time. It can do so for at least another billion years. In that time, it can form another 100 billion new stars from this gas cloud. The thing is, at some point, the gas will run out. You made all your stars, and there's no gas left to make any new stars. And that's when this galaxy starts to go into this second phase of the evolution. And what happens then is that it doesn't stop evolving. The gas is gone, so you don't form any new stars. But the stars that are there start aging, and when a star ages, on average, it gets a bit redder. So this galaxy will get a bit redder. No new stars are formed. But the thing is that this galaxy is by that time so incredibly massive that its gravity attracts all the other galaxies in its surroundings. So basically, the second phase, what it starts doing is that it starts cannibalizing all the other galaxies. And it will keep growing by just eating up the other galaxies around it and just growing larger and larger and larger.
Bjorn, thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I actually hope that the people learn a bit more about the universe we live in.
Bjorn Emens and colleagues write about the formation of the spiderweb galaxy 10 billion light years away in this week's issue of Science.
And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. Or tweet to us at Science Magazine. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and many other apps, or listen to us on the Science site. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi, on behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS. Thanks for joining us. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Looking for some career advice? Wondering how to get ahead or how to strike a better work-life balance? Visit our site to read how others are doing it. Use our individual development plan tool, access topic-specific article collections, or search for an exciting new job. Science Careers, produced by Science and AAAS, is a free website full of resources to help get the most out of your career. Visit sciencecareers.org today to get started.